Top Fives, the show of everything. Top Fives, presented by The Sex Effects. I'm Joey Parati.
And I'm Sean Day.
And folks, we just have a duplicitous... we have a show based around kind of the number two. And another Spanish title from the Ramones, but we will get to that near the end of the show. I'm not looking forward to that segment. Anyway, Shawnee, before we get to all of the loco-ness, how are you, my friend?
Doing good, man. Yeah, it's exciting for tonight. We have some pretty cool lists and just kind of settling into my new space and excited to record tonight.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Joe, how are you doing this week?
Doing all right, man. As I do now, I went up to the city over the weekend, and me and my brother went and saw the movie Us, the new Jordan Peele flick.
Oh, how was it?
I liked it a lot. It isn't as immediate as Get Out. Like, the message isn't, it's a little more opaque. Like, it's a little more, you have to, yeah. I was waiting for the big aha moment. Like, oh shit. Like, that's what's going on. You don't really get that with this.
It's up to your interpretation of, like, how you
a little to, bit. There's a lot more of, like, okay, I've got to decipher this thing for myself, which I appreciate it. I really did enjoy that. So, the performances were all amazing. Jordan Peele is still, I think, one of the most, he's the freshest voice in terms of filmmakers we've had in a very long time.
Yeah.
And I'll be, that's kind of the reason for my list, but we'll get to all that. spent the weekend in the city, and me and my brother went to a bar called The Boardroom, and a bunch of his friends were there, and just a whole day just drinking. I must have had easily over 10 beers. It was phenomenal. And then had some Golden Boy pizza for dinner. And, nice. Came back to my abode on Sunday and just doing chores and things. They're painting and doing some stuff around my apartment, so I can't have Marty right now. He's with my folks. My dog is with my folks, so it is quite lonely at the moment. But I'm hanging in there, man.
Cool.
Yeah, man. Yeah, it's pretty cool. In terms of news and stuff, there's one bit that has set the internet ablaze today, at least for me.
Oh, man.
Did you hear about Zack Snyder's little outburst?
No.
Yeah? All right. So I'm going to enjoy this because I can't fucking stand Zack Snyder as a filmmaker. So he did a whole, like, three-day festival showing director's cuts of all of his movies.
Okay.
Which is quite self-indulgent. Yeah. And then he has Q&As afterwards, right? And someone asked him about, Batman or killing or whatever. And basically said, if you think Batman doesn't kill, you need to wake the fuck up. And, people who lost their fucking virginity to this movie need to fucking... He sounds like a fucking asshole. Let me see if I can find his full remarks. But basically saying, if you believe in the version of Batman who... doesn't kill, which I'm sorry, that has been the established character for 80 years now.
Yeah.
You're living in a fucking dream world. That's his. So here's his quote. Once you've lost your virginity to this fucking movie, and then you come and say to me something about, like, my superhero wouldn't do that. I'm like, are you serious? I'm like down the fucking road on that. It's a cool point of view to be like, my heroes are still innocent. My heroes didn't fucking lie to America. My heroes didn't embezzle money from their corporations. My heroes didn't commit any atrocities. That's cool. But you're living in a fucking dream world. So that's really fucking insulting to over a lot half of fandom.
That's pretty bad, man.
Yeah, he could have handled this whole situation with class and tact.
Yeah.
And then he might, have worked for Warner Brothers again down the fucking line, but he didn't do that. And it's kind of nice because I pay attention hardcore. I'm of the belief that Batman does not kill. That's what makes him a hero. That is the established core of it's more important than the fucking bat, mm-hmm. right? As long as it's Bruce Wayne with a no-kill rule, that's Batman. That's all you fucking need. So I've been kind of voicing that for a long time on the internet, battling fucking trolls and shit. And, it's kind of nice. Today is the first time I've kind of started to see the tide turn. I call them Snihards, the diehard Snihard followers. So it's kind of nice seeing them being like, fuck, you know, he sounds like an asshole and shit, you know, and
yeah.
I've heard he's a very nice guy. Sure, sure. But he can't tell a story worth a fuck. He can't direct a movie worth a fuck. And, but he's a visionary and like his visuals, fuck you. That shit's muddy and drained looking and, no. So this is my rant in response to Snyder's rant. Yeah. Because we do talk about it on the show.
Oh yeah, dude. I mean, I share your passion with it, man. As far as like, you know, it's interesting that, you know, I mean, I know it's like, you know, this is a public thing that got reported, and you know, this thing happened, and you know, people know about it, and with the internet, it's, you know, of course, it spreads like a bug. So, you know, just kind of seeing like, okay, you know, is this the kind of stance that he takes, and like, even people didn't see that in the first place. So, you know, it's very interesting that that kind of comes to light, and I don't know, man.
Vindicated, you know, hey, fucking.
I bet you someone asked about his director's cut of Justice League. Probably.
Just get the fuck out of here with that.
Yeah, come on, man. Yeah.
Release the Snyder cut. Never. Never.
Never.
Because there is no Snyder cut. Anyway,
Speaking
now that
of,
we've alienated our fans, no.
Well, no. Oh, I guess we could transition. I mean, I kind of want to see this film. Shazam is coming out, and I know this is kind of the new. This is kind of the different wave of kind of superhero movies that are going to present to us, and I'm kind of curious. It sucks because we've talked about this before, like the foundation of DC and that kind of film.
It's rocky.
Yeah, it's rocky. So. You know, see where they go from here. I still haven't seen Aquaman. I would like to watch it.
I think that comes out streaming to rent tomorrow, so I might check it out, but probably won't. Did you see Captain Marvel yet?
No, I'm going to see it this weekend, though. This weekend.
You said that last week.
I know. This weekend. I didn't have, like, the whole movie.
I didn't even want to see the fucking movie. I saw it because I thought we'd talk about it on the fucking show. God damn it.
I guess move into a different room and just kind of being occupied with that.
Yeah.
But I do, yeah, I do want to see it. So I might have some time this weekend. Right. I will see it this weekend.
Very good.
Yes. And I definitely want to see Us as well.
Yeah, it's good. Like, Us is like an actual fucking film, you know, which is refreshing. Yeah, man, so we got some lists to get through. Would you like to go first? Would you like me to go first?
I guess I'll go first.
Okay.
The theme is two tonight. So, yes. Joey, what are your favorite movie duos?
So this is really hard. Off the top of my head, I wrote down a list of 10. And narrowed it down to 5, but I don't have them in any order. And I'm really sorry if I have some of yours. Here we go. Number 5, I'm going to go The Odd Couple.
Dude.
Felix Unger and Felix and, oh man, I'm blanking hard right now.
Too.
But Walter Matthau, Jack Lemmon, The Odd Couple. Who are the characters, man?
Who are they, man?
Felix and... I keep seeing Felix, and then I click, and then I... Oscar Madison. How could I forget that? So, yeah, these guys, you know, Oscar is a big slob. Felix is a neat freak, and they're both going through a divorce, and Felix moves into Oscar's apartment, and hijinks ensue. And it's a wonderful, wonderful movie, and their relationship is so good between the two stars. And they... We're in a bunch of stuff together.
Yeah.
But it's done a lot. It's very much like a play.
Okay.
You know, so they'll just kind of put the camera there and then the camera is not moving for a good 10, 15 minutes. And you're just seeing the actors
just
do
observing,
their thing.
Yeah.
And it's scene. Awesome. Cool. Yeah. So I'm going to go with that. That for number 5. Number 4. I'm going to go Step Brothers. I'm going to go
Brennan, dude.
Or Nighthawk. Or Dragon and Nighthawk. Yeah. I love this movie. I saw it at the sneak preview, and just knew instantly that it was going to be a fucking classic. And it really is, you know, you have to be dialed into that sense of humor, but it is, you know, hearing, Will Ferrell call, what's his name, a geriatric fuck is just one of the funniest fucking moments of cinema history, man. So those two, John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell play off each other so well. And, you know, basically Talladega Nights was kind of the proving ground for their on-screen chemistry.
Yeah, yeah.
And this movie, they literally just came up with a plot so loose, so as just to drop them into scenes and let them play off each other. And it works. It shouldn't work, and it works fucking brilliantly.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Step Brothers. Yeah.
Step Brothers. Number three, I am going to go with Indiana Jones and his father, Henry Ooh. Jones Sr.
Senior.
So you've got Indy, who is based loosely off of James Bond, right? Steven Spielberg wanted to make a James Bond movie, and George Lucas went, "No, I've got something better," and and that's kind of how Indiana Jones came to be. So you have Indy, and then you've got fucking James Bond, the James Bond,
yeah,
as his father, and it's a nice bit of kind of symmetry there. You know, if you didn't know the backstory already.
Yeah.
And they play off each other so well, you buy immediately that this is a father and son. All of the, you know, pathos or angst or, you know, of that relationship is so on screen and you feel it. You feel the history between the two of them.
Yeah.
And I think Sean Connery's only like 12 years older than Harrison Ford, so it's really not that big of an age gap, but they play it so well and so believably. So great, man. It's so great.
Cool.
Yeah. Number two. We're going to get another Harrison Ford duo, man.
Oh, here we go.
Han Solo and Chewbacca, or Chewie, because Chewbacca is just way too long of a name. How am I going to say all of that? It's like, really, you're giving them an origin to the nickname Solo. Get the fuck out of here. But as it stands, you know, the introduction of Han and Chewie in the cantina is one of the great character introductions of all time. Han Solo's just leaning, you know, against that bar, like the sexiest motherfucker in the galaxy. The
sexiest laugh.
You know, and you know, it's I think it says a lot about their on-screen chemistry that you can't speak Chewbacca's language. You don't know whatever he's saying, but the way Han Solo reacts to him.
Yeah.
You know what he's saying. You understand their banter, and even if you only understand one side of it, you know, and you can really see the love and compassion that they have for each other, which is a beautiful thing. When Han Solo, don't even talk to me about fucking getting cut down by Kylo Ren, but like when Han Solo gets frozen in carbonite and Chewie lets out that, you're just like, fuck me
no,
too.
I know.
Me too, man.
He's gone.
So it's a beautiful thing. I love Han and Chewie, and yeah. But Shawnee, my number one movie duo, Harold and Lloyd from Dumb and Dumber, man. I mean, is there a better pair? You know, they're on the exact same fucking wavelength in terms of brain power. You know, it gets worse, Lloyd. My parakeet Petey, he's dead. He's dead. How'd he die? His head fell off. He was pretty old. You know, like, there's so many great, you know, moments. According to the map, we've only gone 2 inches. You know, the fact that they think they can use the money with IOUs and all that stuff is just so great. And when they turn against each other, it's fucking hilarious, and they come back together for the stupidest reasons. You know, he's on a little motorcycle. Just when I think you can't get any dumber, you go and do something like this. And totally redeem yourself. It's Dumb and Dumber is a fucking classic movie. Like, it's classic.
It's classic. And like those two characters are the chemistry between them, and the way they like, the how each scene plays out, it wouldn't work without the two of them, you know, as far as that. Yeah. Man, so Lloyd,
that's
dude.
My list. I'm afraid our list may be similar, but I'm very curious to hear what your top five is.
I kind of wrote 10 too as well, so I'm going to switch out a couple.
Very good, very good.
So I've got for number five, I've got Jay and Silent Bob.
Yes. They were on my list of 10 as well.
I know. It's so tough, man. But I don't know. Every time, you know, these two guys are on screen, either in their own film or kind of in the background, but also just they always take the scene when they're in the other films that Kevin Smith has produced. And just the banter they have between each other, the talk between the songs they sing. And of course, you know, Kevin Smith playing as Silent Bob, he's just like, you know, silent the whole time, just being all cool. But he's like, he knows, again, the communication. He knows exactly what Jay's talking about.
Yep, so, yep.
So I number like five, Jay and Silent Bob.
Fantastic.
Number four, I've got... let's see. I'm trying to switch this around. Okay, number five, I've got. Let's see here. I'm trying to. I don't want to. It's like, it's like, do I favor this one over the other? I don't know. Okay, number four, I've got Wayne and Garth.
This was a tough one to leave off. Yeah.
kind of similar to the Jay and Silent Bob. I know Garth's a little more reserved, although Garth is. I feel like he's misunderstood when you look at him, but as an audience, you know, you're led into, like, you know, how he's thinking, and, you know, of course they break the fourth wall a couple of times in the films, but Garth and Wade, Garth and Wade, I'm tired, man. Excuse me for that. Wayne and Garth, yeah, party on, Wayne, party on, Garth. They are just like a fun duo. They play off each other, you know, one's really, you know, just outstanding and, not standing, what am I trying to say? Cut this part out.
Extroverted?
extroverted. And then Garth's like pretty, introverted. So
yeah. It's and they cool got a pool table too.
And they get a pool, but they have little comments they make with each other, and they understand each other, and they're, you know, they have this show together and that friendship too. So it's just like it's they're two of my favorite characters, and they're just so funny together on screen. So Wayne Garth,
love it.
For number three, I've got Lloyd and Harry as well.
Right on.
Freaking love Dumb and Dumber. I mean, everything you said about them, and just the. You know, they could, yeah, of course, they couldn't exist if they, you know, the film wouldn't be the way it is if it wasn't even for, you know, the two of those actors coming together and really kind of playing off each other. And, you know, who knows as far as, like, you know, what was written in the script and what was kind of added in there as an improvised moment. But that's the fun thing about duos on screen, and especially for comedy. I feel like, you know, some of the ones we've mentioned already are, you know, mostly in the comedy genre. So it's, you know, it's interesting that the duos, you know, as far as two actors, you know, being part of the story and getting along with their journey, it's, you know, it's a thing we've seen, you know, time and time before.
Yeah.
So number three, that's so I got number two, right? Number two.
Yeah.
Oh man,
that's tough. He's tough.
Yeah, man. Okay, here we go. Number two, I got Woody and Buzz. Nice. Buzz Lightyear.
Very nice.
Weird fact about that film, that before they were going to make Woody an evil character.
Yeah, he's going to be a jerk.
He's going to be a jerk to Buzz, and the movie was not going to be pretty much made. And out of just sheer circumstance and things coming to play, they ended up with the script, and it became Toy Story and what we know it today.
Yeah.
And our introduction to Buzz Lightyear and Woody. And, I mean, Tom Hanks and Tim Allen bringing those characters to life as far as an animated film and really building the chemistry, developing the chemistry throughout the film. These two characters that, you know, come from different places and being, like, acclimatized to each other and but also finding, you know, the common ground and obviously a friendship in the end of the film is such a great moment. And for a computer animated feature film, being able to portray that and to really bring out the emotions of that is an incredible thing. And as far as those two characters kind of, you know, bring us into that realm, it's definitely a milestone for film, and especially for, you know, the rise and start, I guess, of computer animated feature films.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Very nice.
So we got number two, and then number one, I've got Doc Brown and Marty, man.
Right on. Right on, man.
I mean, Back to the Future is always going to be my favorite film. No contest on that one for me. Still have it up there. And just the thought, like, when you think about Back to the Future and, you know, like, it's Marty, he's a young kid, and we got this, like, crazy scientist dude, Doc Brown. Like, how do they end? Like, I still, like, try to imagine, like, how they met and, like, how they kind of came to be friends. And that's just
a creepy tale right there. I don't know that I want to know it.
Oh, well, that's the thing, too. It's a duo that, when you think about it, like, when you start the film, it's like, that's kind of an interesting relationship that he has there. But the sheer curiosity and just all the different things that aligns with, like, what, Marty, they understand each other in a way, and they can trust each other to the point where they can step in a time machine together and travel through time. So, like, thinking even further into, like, the movie and the characters and that relationship that they've introduced us to, and then, of course, just the journey that they go on and the different things that happen. And you can tell their friendship is so close because, you know, Doc Brown is watching over Marty. Even at the end of the first film, he's like, you know what, I'm going to check in on you in the future and see where you're at. And, it comes back from him in the second film to say, like, something's happening. And it's just these adventures that they have. And it's almost like that whole thing where, what's that saying? You know, sometimes it's like a young man's game, you know, for what Doc Brown's doing. But at the same time, you know, he's also bringing, you know, this young man into his journey, into what he's doing. And it's pretty, like, now that I think about it, like, maybe as a science fiction film, like, and of course this can be said for many films, even in the science fiction genre, like, you know, time travel and the way that's portrayed in the film medium, you know, it's like, it's very detrimental as far as the, you know, how the world's going to turn out, or, you know, it's always like a threat. But the characters of Marty and Doc Brown, it's great because they can translate that to the audience. They can, you know, show that, you know, you can trust them, almost like you become a part of their group. And that's what's great about films, dude, and, like, the characters, and, you know, seeing other characters interact with them. And, you know, of course there's relationships within these movies, so that's why, like, this movie duo thing, when I think about it, it's like, oh, there's some, like, duos, but it's like, it's kind of deeper, like, these characters, you know, the movie itself wouldn't be that movie if it weren't for these working characters. So yeah.
There you go. Yeah, well, very nice, Shawnee. Movie duos. I like it. I can't believe we hadn't done that one before. Very good.
Yeah.
It's quite good. Keeping in the theme with number two. So I saw Us this weekend, and it got me thinking about sophomore directorial efforts. So yes. These are the second movie made by a certain director, any director, which... Now that I think about it, next week I'm going to have to ask you for your directorial debuts. But tonight we're going to keep it with sophomore directorial efforts. So second movie in a filmmaker's filmography. Shawnee, what are your top five?
Oh, man. This was also a tough one because I don't think I've seen a lot of the... I remember some of these directors for their second film, but then I haven't seen their first film.
Oh,
so,
shit.
So it was definitely interesting. And that's why I'm excited, because if we were going to do this list next week... you know, I'll kind of catch up and see if I can watch some of these films and really see these directors for where, you know, what their debut film was and where they kind of took their craft from there. So this list, again, deeper list today too as well. So number five, I've got Memento from Christopher Nolan.
Nice.
And it's following The Following in 1998. And yeah, Memento, I mean, this movie is just, we've talked about it too as well. You know, it's a strange film where the whole movie is played in reverse. Like it's each scene kind of leads backwards. So as an audience, you're starting to trickle down to where this all originated and some things that went astray as far as where characters were led or, you know, the decisions they made, were they influenced by others. So it's a very interesting even movie about choice. Even though the movie's being played in reverse, like you don't really have a choice to, you don't see, you know, you kind of see where it originated from. Where it kind of, you know, it's almost like a magic trick when you kind of find what's revealed with it, but you're trying to like, you can still understand the complexity of the trick itself, you know, like right. Just with this movie, as you're going back and seeing it, it's like, oh, wow, you know, even if you watch this movie in fast forward or, you know, if you in the correct order, I guess, in a way.
I bet, you know, there's a version cut together like that.
Yeah, but what, you know, would it be, the whole experience is watching it backwards and finding it out. So I think that's a very interesting approach to, and a kind of a bold move for your second film.
Yeah, absolutely.
And doing that, and you know, Christopher Nolan, of course, Following and all his other films. I mean, I love his filmography and the way he shoots films, and then of course his emphasis on sound design. So I really dig that. So yeah, Memento for number 5.
I like it.
Oh man. Okay, here we go. Number 4, I've got Eternal Sunshine, directed by Michael Gondry.
Ooh.
Michelle Gondry. Sorry, Michelle Gondry.
That's okay, Shani. And,
yeah.
That's all right.
And the follow-up to Human Nature in 2001.
Nice.
Interesting enough, yeah, we mentioned Jim Carrey in the show today as Dumb and Dumber, but I also have him in a pretty serious drama role in Eternal Sunshine.
Yeah.
And just about the kind of science of memories and relationships and I don't know. It was a really interesting movie, and Michelle Gondry comes from like kind of a music video background and has all these kind of art kind of installations in the in his films. So it's kind of interesting how that translated from that kind of medium to his films. So I'm kind of curious to watch Human Nature just to see if he kind of has he been carrying this way of showcasing his art and right. Like translating these films. And it's, you know, it's certain things. It's the cinematography, obviously, but also the type of other elements that are being used in the film. So and of course, it's Jim Carrey and
Kate Winslet,
with Clementine, and it's a very kind of interesting and I don't know, also just a touching film. So Eternal Sunshine, nice. Number 4.
I still haven't seen it. I feel like it's too raw for me. I don't think I'd be able to handle it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can see what kind of movie it is. I know what it's about, and I just like, nah, I can't go there. I don't think I've ever been able to go there.
It's a favorite of Jim Carrey movie of me because it's different. Like, I mean, I know it's his drama side, but
yeah,
I like how he was in this film, and you know, it made sense to the character and everything. So number 4, Eternal Sunshine. For number 3, I have Snatch in 2000, directed by Guy Ritchie, following up Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, which I have seen and it's awesome. I favored the first one,
nice.
Lock, Stock, Smoking Barrels. That was made in 98. But Snatch.
Daniel Regan's favorite movie.
Ah. I think I've mentioned Snatch before on the show, but yeah, it's definitely I think for Guy Ritchie as a director too, you know, his filmmaking is very, you know, very fast-paced, things happening. There's usually a couple different characters being introduced, and somehow these characters' story arcs kind of tie in later on, maybe even midway or a little bit further into the third act of the film. So it's great. It's very high, fast-paced, and you know, it's about fighters. It's all about a bunch of stuff, thieves. Yeah, it's a fun film, and it's just very, maybe because of that style of filmmaking, like kind of you know, you're continuously being exposed to just so many different scenes. Not, you know, that fast, but as far as just the story is moving along very quickly to amp up, like, okay, you know, these characters are, they have a goal at the end of this film and, you know, they need to meet, you know, they have to eventually go through this journey to get there.
Yeah.
But yeah, Guy Ritchie, and, you know, of course he has a whole bunch of, you know, a whole bunch of different, you know, films with that kind of in mind. So yeah, Snatch 2000.
Very nice.
That's number three. Number two, I've got Pulp Fiction.
Nice.
Quentin Tarantino came out in 1994, following Reservoir Dogs in 92.
Right.
Kind of similar to Guy Ritchie in a way. I know both those directors are very different. They're kind of directing and the way their films even look too. But, you know, taking different storylines and these different characters and the situations that they're in, and weirdly enough, eventually tying them in together and creating these different results, like different things happening to the characters that you wouldn't expect. And, you know, that's always Tarantino. It's just kind of taking you into this, like, okay, here's these different perspectives, and these are people, you know, there's still, you know, somewhat of a good and evil line in yeah. his films too, you know, and of course they're very, very bloody and and all sorts, but you know, Tarantino has his way of making films, and Pulp Fiction has always kind of stood out for me as one of my favorite Tarantino films. So,
right on. Yeah,
Pulp Fiction number two, and then I've got for number one, Shaun of the Dead 2004.
Oh shit!
Edgar Wright.
Nice.
Following A Fistful of Fingers, which I haven't seen, and now I'm kind of interested because that's a very interesting title.
Yeah, it is.
But Shaun of the Dead, man, it was my introduction to Edgar Wright, and it was definitely something I didn't know what to expect, actually, because, you know, the as far as that genre of film, as far as parroting, like, you know, another film or another film genre, you know, that it was nothing new. But as far as Edgar Wright and the way, going back to kind of like action and the way the director and even the way even the way the pacing is as far as scene to scene, and to be able to tell like certain things and certain actions happening within a couple seconds or a couple, you know, maybe like 20, 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Like a great example is the scene where Sean is just simply making toast and like getting coffee for his morning, you know, routine or whatever. And like the scene happens in like, I don't know, less than like 5 seconds. Like it's just a,
you
know,
smash cuts.
Yes. Smash cuts. Yeah.
Yeah.
So like that, like being able to tell that and like make that kind of the humor too, as well as like, this is such a, you know, very intense moment, but it's just a simple task that he's doing just to kind of speed you along or whatever. But other than that, this film is funny, and there's tons of great scenes. My introduction to Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, and you know, they made the Cornetto trilogy with Edgar Wright as well. So they kind of continue that chemistry, and you know, now that I think about it, you know, those two would also kind of be on my duo list. Because they've been in a lot of films together, and I believe they were on I feel like he was on the, because he had a show with, I think,
Spaced.
I don't know if they were in the both same show, but I know that
I think they were, and I'm pretty sure Edgar Wright directed all those as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, immediately, man, that's a strong duo right there, because they've been working together and writing and being a part of those, you know, those movies that he's a part of. So, yeah, man, I mean, Shaun of the Dead, it's hilarious. And of course the zombie genre, like with British humor and I don't know, it's such an interesting film. And, again, there's some really good moments, and that's great. It still carries a lot of humor, and it's funny at times, but also it's like, yeah, it's a pretty intensive story, and there's, you know, there's characters that you know, get lost get lost to the zombies, and you know, there's some family dramas and I don't know. But yeah, Shaun of the Dead for number one.
So I like it. That's a very good choice.
Sophomore directorial.
That was a good choice. Well, we only have one crossover. I'm trying to think if I should just axe it to make room for another.
Ah, there we go.
we both put Pulp Fiction at number two. So I'm going to bump everything up one. Now, Us is the reason for this list. It did not make my list. I like it a lot, and I think everyone should go out and check it out and talk about it and try to figure out what the fuck the message is. But instead, for number five, I'm going to go with... Do I go with the film snob choice of Orson Welles' The Magnificent Ambersons, or do I go with something more from the heart, like Big by Benny Marshall, fucking Seven by David Fincher?
Ooh, wow.
Alien from Ridley Scott.
There's a lot.
These are the ones I'm fighting for number five right now. You know what? I'm going to go with Big.
Big, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Big. You know, Tom Hanks, yeah. But, like, you think about Penny Marshall's direction, and she balances, you know, this kind of sentimental tone. There's drama to it. There are very light and funny parts. And it does give you kind of that wonder and also the fear of growing up and being an adult. And, you know, the world, yeah, he might be bigger, but it's still a big and scary world. And having to figure out how to navigate through that as only a fucking 80s kid could, you know, like 80s kids were fucking resourceful in the movies, man. Think about the Goonies and shit like that. You're just like, man, 80s kids just fucking.
80s kids.
So I'm going to go five, Big. Number four, I'm going to go The Graduate, Mike Nichols. It was his second film after Virginia Woolf, I believe. And have you ever seen The Graduate?
You know, I feel like I've seen it. I need to rewatch it. And
Mr. Feeney's really, in it.
Yeah, taking the film. But yeah, I feel like we've talked about The Graduate. Yeah,
it's very good.
I feel like it's such a staple in cinema history, too, as well, as far as... Well,
just the way that, you know, Mike Nichols is able to move the camera and make you feel as the character is feeling, very claustrophobic, very like everyone's coming at you all at once. I'm thinking specifically of the party scene where he comes home and here, come say hi to this person. Here, they want to say hi to you. Hey, how's it going? Blah, blah, blah. You know, what are you going to do after college? What are you going to do? What do you think about doing? Oh, you want to have a job yet? Blah, blah, blah. It's just fucking... And he needs to escape. And, you know, he holds the shot. It doesn't cut. And you're just feeling like you're fucking drowning. And you feel exactly as the main character feels.
Yeah.
And to be able to direct with such confidence like that is really amazing, especially for your second film. But it's fucking Mike Nichols. So number three, I'm going to go with Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights.
Boogie Nights.
Okay. Yeah. I believe Hard Eight was his first movie. But I mean, Boogie Nights is basically a Scorsese ripoff. It's Goodfellas, but about the porn industry. And he does it every bit as good. Like, every bit as good, almost, as something like Goodfellas. It drags a bit where Goodfellas doesn't drag, like, at all. But it's up there, dude. And his P.T. Anderson is really kind of interesting because, like, I feel like his subjects, the, you know, kind of the troubled male or whatever, is usually the same, but the way he shoots, he doesn't have any one particular style. He adapts his style to suit the subject matter, you know? So of course a story about the 70s porn industry is going to be like a Goodfellas, like, you know, you're overwhelmed and it's fun and it's great. And then the world comes crashing down, you know, it's going to follow that kind of thing where something like, I don't know, The Master or something is very slow and kind of plodding and, you know, kind of meditative. And he can have those different kinds of hats and still be himself, you know. Boogie Nights, to fucking pull off a Martin Scorsese impression pretty much as your second film and succeed, it's pretty fucking good.
Yeah. Boogie Nights, man.
Boogie Nights. Woo. Love Boogie Nights. Number two. This is two now. American Psycho, Mary Harron.
Oh, what?
Yeah. Why? Our first was I Shot Andy Warhol or something like that. But American Psycho is on another level. I mean, on the surface, it's a horror movie, but when you actually watch it, it's a satire. It's darkly fucking hilarious. It is a very funny movie if you watch it knowing to watch it that way, and knowing that the movie is trying to be that. Because you could watch it as a fucking horror movie, and you wouldn't think any differently. You'd go, oh, okay, yeah, I just watched a fucking horror movie, and then
no,
watch it again, but this time, like, look for the jokes. Oh shit, yeah. It does work on that level. We get probably, I think, to this day, probably the finest Christian Bale performance.
Oh yeah, he's totally so in that. Good. He's really into that role.
Yeah. Just the fucking 80s machismo dickhead. Yeah. Fucking great, man. American Psycho. And number one, Kevin Smith, Mallrats. I love Mallrats so fucking much. And I know people really do not like that movie, but it's fucking funny. It's got heart. The conversations with the friends feel kind of real, and even though they're exaggerated largely, they're going from talking about, oh, you know, my girlfriend Brandy, I can't believe she wants to do this, blah, blah, blah. Hey, how do we just go from talking about, comic book sex organs to girlfriend stuff and, in the food court? He's like, the eatery, it's not a food court. Oh, no, it's a cookie stand. It's an eatery. It's part of the food court. No, it's an eatery. It's a standalone mid-mall snacking. And, you know, those kinds of tangents and almost Seinfeld-esque and then again, you have Jay and Silent Bob have a little more of a heightened role. And, you know, Clerks was a black and white film, and people say it had no style. It doesn't really have or Roger Ebert said his style is that he has no style. And that's kind of true again for Mallrats, but that thing pops with color. It's like, holy shit, I get to work with color now. Let's just fucking throw it. You know, it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of color to it. And maybe that's why I always kind of think Clerks first and then Mallrats second, but I just always think of it as such a colorful, fun movie. Because Chasing Amy is much more muted in color.
Muted,
tone.
Yeah. Oh, you're right, man.
But yeah, man. So Mallrats, my number one. Sophomore it's directorial efforts, man.
Yeah, it was a hard list.
It was.
There's so many films that... And now, I want to go back and see some of these from these directors that we mentioned. I want to see their first films because I haven't seen a lot of them.
Yeah,
and
same.
Just to see where they came from and, you know, just trying to get in the mindset of like, oh, we're, you know, going from this film to this film. You know, what are they taking over there? You know, how are they going to change their the way they direct? And so it's a cool little... I like this list, dude. I can't wait for next week now.
I know. I'm excited. So. I'm very excited. Tune in next week, dear imaginary audience, for directorial debuts. But before we get to that, we got some business to take care of.
Oh, yes.
We're at our penultimate Ramones list here, dear imaginary audience. We've gone through their entire studio discography. Should I repeat them?
You do it every week, and right. I don't know how you can memorize all.
I don't either. So every week on the show, we have a weekly segment. We've done them in seasons, if you will. The first season was movies from the year of our birth. The second season was the Beatles discography. This is our third current season, and we're on the Ramones discography. Now, we went through their entire studio recorded albums, Ramones, Leave Home, Rocket to Russia, Road to Ruin, End of the Century, Pleasant Dreams, Subterranean Jungle, Too Tough to Die, Animal Boy, Halfway to Sanity. This is where I start to get a little rocky, Halfway to Sanity, and then I want to say Mondo Bizarro.
Mondo Bizarro, yeah.
Fuck. I know Acid Eaters and Adios Amigos, but there's one in between. There's one before Mondo Bizarro. There has to be.
Let's see.
Are you looking it up?
Got you.
I have failed. It's I said okay. Animal Boy, right? Man.
All right, so we're at Mondo Bizarro, Adios Amigos. Oh, sorry, Mondo Bizarro, Acid Eaters, Adios Amigos.
What was before Mondo Bizarro?
Brain Drain.
Brain Drain, of course.
Brain Drain.
Brain Drain. That's the one I'm forgetting, folks. There we go. There we go. So, yeah. Great. I've just ruined my fucking winning streak.
It's all good, dude.
It's all good, yeah.
You have been such a... I mean, I can't believe... You, every week, I was like, I can't believe you do it every week and just get them all. So,
well, man. we decided to do two live albums to finish off the Ramones. And we're hitting with their later album, their 1991 release, Loco Live, so that we can finish with the way that we like to remember the Ramones next week. next week. But this week, we listened to Loco Live.
Loco
it's recorded in 1991. The band is fucking ragged. you can hear the goddamn miles from all of the traveling and road, you know, shows that they've done.
Yeah.
The set is way too long. They play way too fast. Joey can't remember half the fucking words. this album is, what, 31, 33 songs?
And it's, they, a, you know, yeah, it's a deep set list. Yeah.
Deep set list, and they do shit from their entire discography. Oh, boy, Shawnee. what did you think of this fucking record, man?
I'm kind of feeling the same way as the vibe that I'm getting.
And, yeah.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's like, man, 30-something songs and just, like, going for it. And funny enough, sometimes that kind of, the way it sounded was just, like, that's kind of reminds me of, like, how they used to be as far as, like, their older recordings and just kind of the sluggish kind of feel for them, I would say. But, yeah, it was definitely an interesting listen, especially going through the whole set.
I felt exhausted listening to this record. Yeah. It's like every time that they actually did take a break in between songs, I was like, thank God. Yeah. I need some fucking relief here. And I know they need it because they're old men. It's an exhausting listen. It really is.
That's why it was kind of hard to choose a five for this one.
Yeah.
There are a couple gems in there.
You think so?
I mean, so I'm going to start off with my five.
All right, Warthog. Yeah, let's hear it. Yes,
I dug Warthog.
That made mine.
Maybe because it's like, it was just, that song is just kind of fitting for like, I mean, they could just be thrashed out and, well, and of course now they're older, but.
I have a theory about this. Okay. I think, and I don't know if your list will reflect this or not, but I think the newer Ramones songs or the latter day Ramones songs sounded better on this album than because it's shown a light on how whenever they play like an early Ramones song, it just it's shown how far they'd come and not in a good you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's kind of how with the newer stuff, it was kind of like, all right,
No, I had that in mind. Like, it's like, yeah, of course, you know, I'm very fond of like the first couple records and. You know, yeah, this is, you know, we're hearing the set a little bit later in their career, obviously.
A little bit.
I mean, with a little bit. But Warthog, I don't know, it was very just, it just was fitting for the kind of show it felt. And
yeah,
just fast. And yeah, they played twice. I mean, it seemed even faster.
Does it bug you that Warthog doesn't follow Durango 95 on this release?
Yeah, although it was cool because they opened with Durango. Didn't they open with like Durango 95?
Yeah.
And I was going to put that on my list. Oh, man, I think I might put that on there. Ooh, I don't know. It's not, nah. It's, I think it wouldn't make my five, but I thought that was kind of interesting. Like, they didn't follow each other. And I know they kind of, yeah, they are somewhat like lead into each other in a way. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Warthog. So I got number five, number four, I've got Pinhead.
Right on.
I don't know. Just like the chanting. It's like, it's such a classic kind of like, Ramones song and like the way they, the kind of chant they do. Gabba gabba wheeze. It's, you know, I feel like that's like, it's still a moment for them to kind of connect with their audience and like, get them, you know, shouting and chanting and
for sure,
you know, it really brings the, it intensifies like the show when you have songs that can, you know, be easily, you know, sung along to, or you know, get the crowd involved.
Yeah.
And it's yeah, faster. I love some of these songs fast. Don't get me wrong.
Absolutely.
Pinhead sounds pretty fun fast. So number four, Pinhead. Number three, the KKK Took My Baby Away.
Right on.
I was actually surprised. I know he, like, Joey doesn't sound as good as far as vocally on this, but I mean, he, as far as some of the slower songs or just kind of like these more ballady songs,
he can bring
it. I really like this one. And, I'm trying to remember where it is in the set. I think it's like in the first, like,
first 10 maybe,
yeah, out of the 30.
Yeah,
so you know,
first third of the show.
Yeah, part way there. So it's good to have some songs that, you know, again, it's even played a little bit faster. Like it still has that kind of ballady kind of vibe, or like that just kind of slower feel. So it's good to have songs in the set like that to kind of slow the rhythm down a little bit. Even though it's still fast, but you know, not as intense as like Warthog or something.
Right.
So number three, the KKK Took My Baby Away. Number two, I Believe in Miracles.
Oh yeah, that was good.
Which is, I think, one of the first couple of songs. I'm trying to remember how this one went, but I don't know. I just put it down because I just maybe it's like early on in the set, so like they're kind of at that, they're warmed up stage, but like they're starting to get into it, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, like the performance is a little bit, you know, I think they're kind of getting into it. And then as the show continues, it kind of slowly goes down. But
yeah.
So I Believe in Miracles, number two. And then I will always like this Ramon song. It's Teenage Lobotomy for number one.
Right on.
And I think because of that, just it's like a classic Ramon song. Again, it has some really good moments for the crowd to shout and connect, and it's just fun. I just want to like dance around to that song. So.
Right on.
But yeah, number one, Teenage Lobotomy. So,
very good, Shawnee.
Interesting record, man.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know. Yeah, you're kind of right. You kind of nailed it on the head as far as the kind of overall kind of vibe of the songs and the track listing.
It was, you know, I was thinking about it. There's no harmonies anymore. It's too fast for harmonies.
Yeah.
And like early Ramones always had the harmonies, and that's kind of what elevated their sound and everything.
Yeah. Man, you're right.
You know?
Like not hearing a lot of that throughout the, that's also the just, performance too, man.
It's very stop-go. And the Ramones have always been stop-go, but it felt so like grinding of gears here. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
It makes sense.
Number five, and this is kind of a throwaway, Surfin' Bird. This is, I think, the worst sounding song on this record, which is, I put it number five because I want to talk about it and how fucking atrocious it is. Like, Joey straight up just forgets lyrics and instead, like, you'll notice this throughout a lot of the songs. Like, he'll just stop singing and just say, and like kind of hum
coast through the lyrics.
Yeah, and you're just like, huh. But it's like almost the whole song is doing that here. And then, you know, there's that wonderful moment in the recorded version of Surfing Bird where the song stops and it's like this vocal solo with a lot of effects, like meow meow papa meow meow papa. And but it's so slow on this version. It's like he really is taking like a ma 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 ma
Oh my gosh, dude, that's so funny you notice that, because yeah, that song in particular, yeah, I was like, oh man, this is kind
of, it was rough. It was rough, but I think that's very exemplary of this album. So I put it number five. Number four, these are ones that I actually thought sounded okay. Mama's Boy.
Oh yeah.
Which he referred to as a sing-along, which I was like, huh. I would not ever refer to that as a sing-along. Anyway, number three, Pet Sematary, I thought sounded pretty good. I agree with you that the KKK Took My Baby Away sounded pretty good. And number one, I'm going to go with Psychotherapy. I've always really liked that song, and I think it works with Latter-day Ramones sound, that kind of harder, like, are we like a motorcycle band or like what are we? Kind of like, you know, the Ramones almost try to go too hard sometimes, and I think it works in that instance.
Okay, yeah.
So, yeah, and that song just fits the Latter-day Ramones. So that's my local life. Next week, we're going to do something much better, and we're going to talk about It's Alive. Probably, like, if, you know, it's probably the best Ramones record, to be quite honest. But
I haven't listened to it, like, all, like, as far as all the way through. Like, that's what was interesting about this local live, and even though it's the first time listening to it for I think, have you listened to local live, Joe, before?
I had on CD. I don't think I'd ever been able to make it all the way through. Yeah. But I'd listened to a lot of it to know. Yeah.
Yeah. So same for this next week. Like, okay. Heard a couple songs, but yeah, haven't listened from track to track, you know?
Yeah.
Which is going to, you know, that's what's great about like live CDs is getting the feel for like the concert and being there. So I am getting kind of excited because this one was a rough one this week.
It's Alive has kept me awake and excited on drives where I should have fallen asleep at the wheel. So yeah. I credit that album with saving my life many times.
There we go.
right on. Shawnee, do you have anything you'd like to share with our dear imaginary audience this week?
Yeah. So it's kind of funny. I was watching a YouTube video. This guy, Andrew Hong that I've subscribed to. He's a producer, musician, like YouTube influencer. And he always posts like very interesting kind of videos about different kind of music production software. And since I do music production, I clicked on one of his videos today, and I saw this video. It's a video about this company, and they because he usually partners up with other kind of music companies and instrument companies. And I think they're from Sweden, but this company called Polyan. Sweden. This company called Polyan Percussion created this drum machine, and it's like a trigger that... attaches. It's like a. Imagine it's a robotic drum machine where it hits the parts of the drum kit, but it has this like this precise beater on it, like this little like
as
this
a beater. Little... You said beater.
Yeah. Well, it has this little. I guess anyone who does I don't know. It's kind of hard to explain. It has this thing at the end, so it's supposed to look like a. Something to hit the drums. So there's like a stick with like a little mallet or kind of soft thing at the end, and it automatically, what it does is the program triggers it and then it hits the drum kit. So you can essentially use this you can program it in your computer, and you can like send that information through these robotic drum playing things or whatever. And it can make very precise hits, and it's really crazy because, like, as far as what you can do on a computer and like the dividing of notes and like, you know, how many hits you can hit per minute, you can get pretty crazy because it's a computer, you know.
Yeah.
And this this kind of stuff that I just saw in this video was triggering machine, drum machine doing those precise hits. With the designed, I guess the tip, I call it the beater, the tip of the beater instrument. That's
it. Fuck out of here! You know what you're doing. You know what you're doing.
yeah. Sorry to get a little. It's hard to explain some of these things. But anyways, I just saw this video, and it's interesting to think about because it's like, whoa, like, you know. Computers, obviously, you know, we can use computers now to play instruments, you know, and like it's how most music is created also as well in these days in the digital age. And as someone who produces music and seeing like, you know, what that does, it blows my mind because it's like, wow, like can you have
yes,
that that I'm blanking out, sorry. No, it's just, can you have the, you know, there's like the ethical divide with, you know, with musicians and like, you know, robots taking over and taking over the craft. But as a like a music producer, using that as a tool, if, you know, I can immediately record these different live drum sounds, you know, in a fast way and program it to the to how I want it, like, you know, that's kind of a crazy thing to do. So I found that interesting. I know that's kind of aimed a little bit at the kind of music production side, techie kind of stuff, but that's the stuff I've been, you know, kind of like really into.
Shawnee, I think we just figured out what your time travel movie is going to be.
Oh, man.
You're going to need to travel back in time to stop machines from creating evil fucking music. And you're going to need to play organic, beautiful music.
That's cool.
On your guitar. I'm very excited for
Joey,
that movie.
What do you have to share this week, man?
Let's see. I got a Criterion release for you. Detour. If you've never seen it, it is a movie. I'm going to find out what year it is because that's very important. I believe it's from the 40s. But it's a beautiful B movie from 1945. And Edgar G. Ulmer is the director. And it's just all the classic film noir tropes that you could ever imagine are thrown into this movie. You know, the dude shows up, you know, to kind of a roadside bar and is really aggravated and like, you know, someone plays a song on a jukebox and it starts like his flashback, and the movie is all his flashback, and what they do with shadows is beyond fucking amazing, and the black and white cinematography is beautiful, and, you know, there's a dangerous dame, and there's murder, and there's accidental murder, and it's very hokey. Like, it's very, you know, he's always like, that's the stuff. And somebody asks for a change for a dime at one point. I was like, holy fuck. there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of really weird stuff. The way he describes the female lead at one point is hilarious. I wrote it down because it was so funny. It said, this is voiceover, you know, he's looking at her and the camera's just, she's in profile. She was beautiful. Not the beauty of a movie actress, mind you, or the beauty you dream about when you're with your wife, but a natural beauty. A beauty that's almost homely because it's so real. That line connected with me for some reason, I don't know why. But I was like, holy fuck, this guy just went there. It's a great movie. I'm probably not doing a good job of selling it. But it's out on Criterion with wonderful special releases, 4K digital restoration. And, but yeah, Criterion Spine number 966. So check it out.
There we go.
Check it out.
Check it.
Shawnee, where can we find more of your work on the internets this week, my friend?
You guys can find me on Instagram at ShawnDayMusic and on my website, ShawnDayMusic.net.
Net.
Joe, where can we find you,
you can
on the internet?
Check me out on Twitter and at Instagram at Joey Parati. And you can check out my website, Joey Parati Scripts. com. You can check out the show at Top 5 Pod. That's TOPFIVE 5 POD on Instagram, on Twitter at gmail.com, and we're on Facebook at Top 5 Podcast. Please check us out on SoundCloud, on Google Play, and on Apple iTunes. Give us a like, give us a listen, give us a follow, give us your love, and goddamn it, we will give it back to you tenfold. Shawnee, until next time, I am Joey Parati.
And I'm Sean Day.
Thanks
for
get low, motherfucker.